Mini episode 85 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
All right, folks, mini episode number 85 of the FDH Lounge and part two of the nine-part anthology, History of WrestleMania. Rick Morris and Kyle Ross here for the Lounge. Kyle, the originator of this series.
Yes, I noticed, by the way, every time you say the part whatever of our nine-part look, you kind of give me a look as if to say, and who else in the hell do you think is doing this with me? All right, what other sick son of a bitch would dedicate 15 hours of his life to talking about the history of WrestleMania?
If any of the dignitaries came to me and had an idea for a nine-part anything, I don't know if I'd bite on it, but if it's Kyle Ross saying nine-part history of WrestleMania, I am signing that on the dotted line.
What's funny about it is when I sent you the email originally about this, I'm like, oh my god, this could take years.
Yeah.
Like, this could take years.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want any of the other dignitaries to regard this as any kind of a precedent for anything. Rick, I'd like to do a nine-part series with you on the history of the NBA quarterfinals. Nope, sorry, I'm not interested. You know, but this is what it comes down to here is WrestleMania 3.
This is a stand. This is will be, I believe, I think it's our only standalone part.
I think so, and it's one of the most important ones in the history of the company. Maybe the most important one.
Yeah.
As we did with 1 and 2, as we talked about, let's talk a little bit about the macro and a little bit about the micro as far as what set it up. This was the first big dome show. This was the progenitor of the dome shows that would come. Subsequently, their first time of really doing one of these things here, and
it's the only one of the first five they did in a big stadium setting.
Yeah, it was the one that set the table for it. And as I started to indicate to you off air, I see this. Here's something that I see about the wrestling boom of the '80s that's kind of overlooked. In the '90s, we kind of see that there were two chapters of it. The first one started with the NWO in 96 really kind of blowing it up. And the second chapter started when it was the ships passing in the night, spring of 98. Austin goes on top in the WWF, and they take over and never look back.
Did 1990 to 96 not count? Or, I mean, because it really didn't. But
well, the boom period.
Okay, gotcha.
We're talking about the boom.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Just when business was on fire, you're saying.
Yeah,
okay.
So that period of 96 to 01 or 02 or however you bookend it, I would say 01 because it really fell off after WrestleMania 17.
Which is a point that I want your listeners to keep in mind while we talk about WrestleMania 3.
Yeah.
Wink, wink.
How that fits in, yeah. But here's the thing. I would argue to you, Kyle Ross, that in a quiet way, the 80s boom kind of mirrored that because you had the first part of it that started with the national expansion in 84.
Yep.
You had Hogan going on top. I'd say the first part of the boom culminated in the first WrestleMania and about a month or two later in Saturday night's main event.
Yeah.
That was what set the table for the first part. Now we are getting into the second part of the 80s boom in 87 because WrestleMania 3 did it, but that was a year, we're going to talk about this, turnover in terms of talent. There's going to be names that we don't talk about as being on this show, but you had DiBiase coming in, you had Duggan coming in, you had at a certain point Rick Rude coming in, Bam Bam Bigelow coming in, names that would loom large for the rest of the decade. You know,
and I think it's important because this, for most people, just because the size of the mythology that comes along with WrestleMania 3 is the pinnacle of 1980s wrestling for most people.
Yes,
I would agree with that. First of all, anyone who holds that opinion, I do agree with that. We talked about in the first part of this nine-part series that you know they didn't really get WrestleMania right with 1 or 2. 1, it was a success. It obviously set this table for Vince dominating this industry. 2 was a step back. You know, they tried the 3 locations, didn't work. This is the first WrestleMania that I think looks, and granted, I mean, 1987, the difference between production TV presentation is a lot different from 1987 to 2012, but I think this was the first WrestleMania that looked like what we expect a WrestleMania to look like. Obviously, the crowd, you know, I mean, these hipsters, you know, they always like to thumb their nose of Vince inflated the attendance figures. That's fine. It still drew a big crowd, okay?
Yeah.
That's my point, okay? It's still, okay, you can talk about numbers. You want 78,000, 93,000, whatever it is. Okay, when you put the show on and you look at it, you're like, that's one big crowd.
Right.
Okay, I mean, that this to me, you know, WrestleMania 1, I think Vince was able to inject wrestling into the mainstream. This was the show where it said, hey, you know, I won. Okay. And to me, after this show, all the competition died. Because none of them could ever do something like this. The AWA was already pretty much dead.
It accelerated the death of the AWA. 86 was a bad year. 87 started the truly putrid death throes of the AWA.
Yeah, I mean, they still had, you know, Kurt Hennig on top, but, you know, I mean, he was looking for his first ticket out of there.
Right.
But, you know, and then the NWA had a bad year in 87.
Well, and that was when they absorbed the UWF and did it without an invasion because of the egos involved, Dusty's and everybody else's here.
Yeah,
they
Mid-South
blew it.
Clubs. World class was, for
world
all intents
class,
and purposes, dead. I mean, they did that awful Fritz von Erich heart attack angle, I think, was in 87.
Ken Mantell was running opposition under the banner of Wild Wild West, I think, against them. I think that was the name of the promotion.
Regardless, it was bad. The free
truly
works,
awful.
Yeah, it was so, but, awful. You know, back to the good times. And I've said, and I think this would surprise people who, you know, listen to the old SNS at the time. You know, I know that we got into some spirited debates back in those with some different folks about, you know, obviously my opinions on the main event of this show, Hogan Andre, most famous match in the history of the industry. But a match that, you know, for personally, I mean, isn't my favorite. And to me, I don't think, historically speaking, it is the most favorite, but it's not a lot of people's favorite match.
Right.
I mean, we'll talk about that later. But,
right.
But it is certainly a celebration of that era. And what makes this show, and I'll rehash this probably one or two more times during this podcast, and then again when we talk about WrestleMania 17, which are, you know, these two are widely considered to be the two best WrestleManias. I think 95% of people would name one of those two as the best wrestling
shows
ever.
That are regarded as the anchors of the respected boom periods.
Yes, which is the key. But this was, and it's interesting that I say this because the gears are turning in my head, the boom kind of slowly and gradually declined after the show. This was the peak of the 80s boom period, okay? This show. But to me, it was a celebration of the era. WrestleMania 17 killed its era, and that is why,
combined with the invasion,
but if you look at the ratings before the invasion,
right,
okay, when they turned Austin heel, and we're getting way ahead of ourselves here,
right, but these are interesting comparisons.
They plummeted in April of 2001.
They did but they recovered for a huge buy rate. I was at the invasion and that had a huge buy rate.
That's what I'm saying. They could have recovered, and that's a way different story for a different day. You know, in parts, you know, five or six for those keeping score.
No, but it's interesting to compare the commonalities between eras.
But to me, if they the WrestleMania 3 equivalent of what they did at 17 is if they did some, and this is, it's going to be laughable what I'm going to say, because this just never entered their minds and is so ridiculous.
Hogan Andre double turn?
No. It would have been if, like, Heenan and Hogan aligned to trick Andre and, like, aha, we made you look like an idiot, you know?
That's what I mean, double turn.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
That would have been funny.
Yeah, that would have been, I mean.
But I mean, it would have killed business.
Yeah, it would have basically been the stupidest thing ever, okay?
Right.
And they didn't do it.
Right.
Okay. They did something pretty stupid at the end of it. To me.
Right.
Here's the thing. People, because of the snowflakes and that mentality that have come about with the internet, and, you know, I'm a big part of that, obviously.
Sure.
Okay. Because the match quality is superior overall in WrestleMania 17, people will tend to give that the nod. The booking of WrestleMania 3 is far superior to WrestleMania 17.
Yeah, that's
far
true.
Far superior, and it has the best match of either show.
Very interesting. We'll talk about that.
Which is debatable, but not in my eyes, it isn't.
I have an interesting and perhaps controversial point on that match. We'll get to that.
Oh, I might bury you badly.
Okay.
I might rip you real bad. I might rip you real bad if you start. Okay.
All right. Yeah. Depending on what I have to say, and I think you're picking up what I'm putting down.
Don't
about
be
that
a death valley. Okay. That was some of the just manure. some of the viewpoints I've read. Don't get involved that manure. I'm going to rescue you. I'm going to rescue you, Ricky, because I already don't like what I'm hearing and I ain't heard it.
All right. we'll get to that subsequently. Let's start here. As we go further along in WrestleMania history, there are less matches that had basically no program implications to them. There's only a handful on this show out of the 12 matches.
Yeah, that's all to me. And this for me, again, you know, you try to when you evaluating wrestling objectively. Okay, mm-hmm. It's not a very serious. I've never taken it seriously. Okay, I'm not Buck Woodworth. Okay,
yeah.
All right. Okay. All right. Okay. To me, it's just fun to do. Okay.
I don't like what was the team in TNA in 06?
LAX.
Yeah,
yes.
I don't like LAX. I like Buck, but I got to rip him for that.
Okay.
One.
Yeah. They won. Never mind. I'm not going there. I was going to say something about the Observer you're in, Paul. But that's okay. Hey, now.
That's okay. He doesn't write for PWI anymore, so you can couple those together.
Oh, he doesn't even
know. Okay, that's you didn't get the memo?
If a tree falls in the woods. Okay. Okay. Anyway. All right. I'm kidding. Partially.
We keyed.
Yeah. But with this is, look, this was the first WrestleMania that I was, I don't want to say a part of because I wasn't a part of, but you know what I'm saying? Like, I started watching wrestling probably, I was in many ways, you know, Vince McMahon, like one of many. I came in 1986, you know, Hogan was a huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was, you know, 6 years old, followed it, and I started watching right when the syndication turned over.
Okay.
That's a big point we need to talk about here, Ricky.
Yeah.
From WrestleMania 2, the syndication became Superstars of Wrestling and Wrestling Challenge. It was really cleaned up. Again, the production was much better for those than it had been for Championship Wrestling, which was the old anchor in the Cindies for them. And All American on USA and stuff like that they were doing. And, you know, Tuesday Night Titan show, that cup of coffee. But I came in at the perfect period, like early fall of 86, which is when they turned over the syndication.
Right.
So, that must have been, I don't know what. I couldn't tell you why I started watching. I just did. I enjoyed it from the first minute. You know, what did you get during that period? Piper Adonis, Savage Steamboat, those feuds starting. You know, moving forward, you had the Bulldogs and the Hearts angle with, you know, the Hearts cheating to win the titles, the famed Danny Davis angle.
That's true, yeah. More stuff happened on TV.
Yeah. And then obviously, of course, the big one, Hogan Andre, those unbelievable Piper's Pits.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about promotion. That's how you promote a big. Now, granted, it helps when you get big names like that.
Right.
Now, it was not their first. There were a lot of lie. There's a lot of lying that it was involved in the promotion of this. But who cares?
Right.
It's wrestling. Okay. I mean, Andre was not undefeated for 15 years. Okay.
Right.
He did not weigh 700 pounds, Hulk Hogan. Okay. He was not 8 feet tall.
All right.
But it was the two huge and everything was just from an. I talk about the mythology of this event and the nostalgia. I think. It's just very rosy when you look at this, and this to me was just how you book. We talked about how in the first couple of WrestleManias they were still mindful of the house shows.
Right.
You started to see a little bit of a turn away with this show. You had very decisive blow-offs in several of the major programs.
Let me speculate as to why. They were about 8 months or so away from the institution of the Survivor Series. The next year we would see SummerSlam coming into the rotation.
Yeah.
This was the beginning of pay-per-view.
This buy rate is impossible to break. I don't have – shame on me. I don't have the number.
Right.
You can look it up, folks. It's astronomical. The pay-per-view universe was still very small in 87.
Right.
So, I mean, it was like the percentage of people that had pay-per-view that – ordered this show,
right.
Is just astronomical.
Right.
I mean, it's there will never be an event that can match a buy rate like that.
Topped only by a 99.5 buy rate for a Riki Dozan pay-per-view in Japan in 1961.
There you go. Yes, exactly. You know what I'm saying? It's things that, like, because the pay-per-view universe is so much larger now.
Right.
You know, there's so many things. You know, it'll never be. I mean, this was... It was still close. This one was still hyped in the closed circuits.
Yeah.
You know, something that, yeah, I'm not sure
this
when.
This was transitional, yeah.
I'm not sure when they totally got away from the closed circuits, because they weren't even doing them in, like, WrestleMania 6 and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, toward the end of the decade.
But, this was, to me, it's interesting you bring up, because pay-per-view, obviously, he put the second pay-per-view on to screw Starrcade at the end of the year, and then a third pay-per-view was added in 88, and then a fourth in 89. So, yeah, we started to see things away from that.
You can draw a line to putting, you know, more blow-offs and stuff like that overall on pay-per-view to the beginning of certainly not de-emphasis in 1987 of the house shows, but a pointing to that's where the business is going to go in the next 10 years.
Yeah.
And did go.
Yeah, yeah, because the house shows, you know, we've talked about like some of the great runs and they became certainly less important. There weren't a lot of big drawing angle house show angles because Andre after WrestleMania 3 takes pretty much the rest of the year off until the Survivor Series. The main program on the house shows in the summer was Hogan Harley Race,
that's a pretty interesting
Savage
thing
Honky,
right there.
Honky was pretty good on the drawn as the Intercontinental Champion. He drew pretty well
on the B shows. Yeah,
yeah,
definitely.
Like it's Savage, you know.
Let me ask you this: when we did our previous mini episode that we had done on mid-90s wrestling, a slump period, but a precursor kind of for the things that would happen during the boom period of the late 90s, we talked about how the house shows in both companies absolutely plummeted in the early 90s, 92, 93.
Depth was a major problem there.
In some ways, as we look at it now, hindsight being 2020. We don't want to be hindsight guy. But I'm putting two and two together here, and I'm saying maybe that's not surprising because maybe by 92, 93, people were getting the memo already that, you know what, let's hold off, man. Maybe the important stuff's happening on pay-per-view now. Did that have anything to do with crashing the house shows as much as they were? I know things were bad, period, but 92 on paper and 93 should have been a bad year for the WWF, but 92 not so much. They had a lot of things popping that year.
Yeah, there was a lot of things. The key was just the loss of Hogan. During this period, you could just throw Hogan out there against anybody. You talk about Harley Race. I think a lot of newer fans hear Hulk Hogan, Harley Race. I'm not going to go see that. That's not interesting. Who do you think is going to win? That's the mentality now. That sold out the Garden back-to-back months.
Well, here's the thing, too, as we start to tie it back to the show specifically here with Harley Race and Hogan. And I can note here, it has been confirmed off-air by producer Steve, great job by the FDH New York Bureau, that Harley Race will be coming on the show. And I'll get to ask him about this, but
Not this show,
but a subsequent very, very soon edition, mini episode of the FDH Lounge. Calling him the king was a substitute for overtly acknowledging his history, which they wouldn't do for anybody.
You see,
if they said seven-time NWA champion, which is very close to what they would say 4 years later for Ric Flair, would that have popped things anymore in 87?
No.
You don't think best in the world there versus best in the world here? That's a big seller.
But it was a little different than the Flair situation. Race's finest years were behind him.
Flair was the incumbent champion.
When they brought him in 86, he had been 3 years removed from the world title reigns. But I'll say this, it's kind of odd that we're going on. Well, if he's going to be on, I think we should make note of him. Certainly Harley Race. But, it's kind of assumed or it's the common theory that was sort of like a rib on him to be the king. I didn't take it that way. I thought it was...
I think the presentation was a rib. The purple robe was like his dusty polka dots, I thought.
Really?
So I think the presentation...
it was a little goofy. I remember there were a lot of throne jokes when they did a thing in a midget.
Yeah, Piper put the throne or put the toilet on his head on Piper's pit.
Yeah. He was a babyface, though.
That's true.
I thought it was a good way to get him all, and the king, like you said, it was sort of like a subtle acknowledgement because neither company would acknowledge if a guy was a previous champ.
That's true.
Nobody
was jumping Crockett's way. So
that's interesting, but it's funny because the first real time, Flair was sort of, they never said WCW or NWA, he was the real world's champion.
Right.
The first time you ever heard an acknowledgement was... It's funny you bring over no one jumping Crockett's way, but it was when Hogan jumped to Turner in 94.
Yeah.
Who are you? What are you going to ignore Hulk Hogan's they're like a five-time WWF champion,
Except they went the other way and treated that as being more important than anything anybody in their company had ever done.
Yes.
Classic Eric Bischoff overcompensation.
Yeah. Okay, but, for this show, all of the romance and nostalgia mythology is so old school. There's probably no wrestling show I've watched more than this show.
Okay.
And I could put it in tomorrow and enjoy it.
As we scroll from the macro to the micro here, level, and looking at the first we'll look at the matches that didn't have storyline attachment to them.
Oh, I was just going to say, though, okay, if you want to do that. But, yeah, there were just a lot of just well-built programs with names that people remember here.
Yeah.
You know, you have the Hogan Andre, Savage, you know, I kind of went through Savage, Piper, right. Adonis, you know, stuff like that. So there was a lot, you know, and as we kind of move forward, the next four WrestleManias or so,
mm-hmm.
totally different mentality, where they just threw, like, a lot of poop at the wall. There was a lot of matches that didn't have programs. And unlike WrestleMania 1 and 2, they weren't saving nothing for the house shows.
Oh, okay? Exactly.
Just, yeah, I mean,
that was the best they could do at the time.
This is easily. There is not a single soul alive.
Yeah. To paraphrase previous lounge guest Christopher Cross, that was the best they could do.
Yeah. We'll talk about that.
Okay.
But there is not a single soul alive that doesn't think this is the best of the first nine run. Even those who still say that don't think this is the best WrestleMania of all time, there's no one that doesn't think this is the best of the first nine WrestleManias.
At least the first seven. Might there be some people thinking eight might be somewhere in there?
They watch the second half of the show?
That's true. Well...
it's not a bad show, but come on, man.
All right,
you know.
I'm just going off the top of my head here, but you may have a point.
You're trying, yeah.
This was
the most famous event in the history of the industry, headlined by the most famous match, and it is, in my opinion, the best WrestleMania of all time.
It's funny because my now shredded segue about how, you know, with the undercard matches that didn't have a build.
We'll get to those. But they're few and far between.
Well, Rick Martel, we were talking about this about Harley Race. His history wasn't acknowledged. Rick Martel, as a year and a half AWA world champion, completely unacknowledged. He was in a tag team with Tom Zenk, the Can-Am Connection, very much over, very much popular. If they didn't later in the year have a schism between them and Zenk left the promotion, would have gone on to a nice run as champions.
Yeah, they were already planned at
this point. This was the build match.
They were really new. They came in, and you're right, Martel, former AWA champion, put in a tag team.
Yeah.
Now, it's funny, though, behind the scenes, though, and you kind of just acknowledged, he was a little bit acknowledged that he had been an AWA champion because he was being paid substantially more than Zinc, which is what led, to the team dissolving and them having to, you know, put Santana with Martel. But this team had already, I think the long-term plan was they had already kind of slotted them in to beat the Hearts down the line in 87, and they put them. This is they wrestle. You know, again, you talk about transition. Bob Orton and Don Morocco, two guys have been
on their way down the card.
They had been reliable hands for several years. Part of, you know, they were big time players. You know, even though Morocco wasn't on the first WrestleMania, and he curtain jerked a second, not indicative of his role in the company during that period. He was a major player, as was Orton, obviously with Piper.
Interesting. Morocco might have been the guy least represented on WrestleManias relative to his importance to the company at the time.
He wrestled Hogan in that Saturday's Main Event in 86. Yeah. We talked about it. He had some good feuds. He had a good feud with Steamboat, obviously, when the Steamer first came in. But, Orton was, you know, they came together as a result of the Piper-Adonis angle. You know, Orton, when Piper left, became Adonis's bodyguard. He had a great pink cowboy hat.
Yep.
Morocco was on the Piper's Pit where they beat Piper down.
Right.
And so they kind of just formed a heel team.
TNT, Tank and the Technician. Weren't they calling them that?
Were they?
I think so. And the Technician.
I don't even remember that. Well,
I do.
Good for you. I'm not going to deny you that.
They didn't use it that much.
No, I mean, they didn't say it on this show, but...
No.
But,
like, you know how it was at the time. Like, every tag team had to have a name.
Yeah, but this was kind of weird because this is, like, kind of more something you'd see today.
Right.
We kind of, like... get two guys.
Right.
Well, even at least they had a reason to get together.
Right.
Okay, unlike now, they just, you know, throw Kofi Kingston and R-Truth together.
I was going to say R-Truth and
because
Miz. This is like how R-Truth and Miz
got they're
both
black. But these guys at least had a commonality from the Piper thing. But
Orton
was gone pretty quick after this.
Right.
Morocco turned babyface.
Subsequently.
Yeah.
You know, they were total, and it's interesting.
But they were here just to put over the Can-Ams.
Right. And
which is what they should have done.
They weren't as overt as SD Jones or George Wells at the previous ones, but they were essentially jobbers to the stars here. They were here to put over the Can-Ams to be that stepping stone to the tag team titles.
But unlike, you know, to your point, they actually had some name value. It was kind of like, you know, in a mentality, okay, that's a big win for the Can-Ams.
Right,
you know?
It shows you how the cards had progressed. Now the jobbers to the Stars had name value. They were guys that were on their way down the card repaying the favor.
What newer fans have to understand favors. Unlike today where there's fewer people over than ever before.
Right.
They did a very good job of keeping a lot of people over during this time period.
They did. So I'm going to go through the ones here first that had no or little storyline build.
But when you look, it's not a great match, but give it a check mark because it accomplishes its goal.
It did. 5:37, it wasn't long, but it accomplished its goal. At 3:39, something that accomplished no discernible goal, Butch Reed with Slick defeated Coco Beware. Boy, you talk about let's put two wrestlers together because they're black.
Yeah, well, again, though, I mean, Coco was weird because
The jobber to the Stars.
It was almost from the. I guess it was just because he was so small, you know.
But here, it was the curse of being a great worker. He could make the other guys look good. He could take great bumps. You looked spectacular if you were in there with Coco Beware and he was eating your offense. That's the curse of guys that are great workers but are deemed too small or too lacking in one area to get over their own.
He really, he kind of like got on that jobber to the Stars platform pretty quick.
He did.
He didn't. He was relatively. He came in that end of '86 period.
But here's the thing:
both these guys are pretty. Reed was real new.
But Coco,
and he was doing that. You know, the natural gimmick. He's a black guy, blonde hair. Ha ha ha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and here's the thing: you and I were laughing off air about how fans react today to Santino Marella. And how they still react. He's bulletproof. He's bulletproof because his stuff gets over. Coco was bulletproof because of the bird, and he'd do the same.
And pile driver.
And everything like that.
It was
he'd
kind
go
of
out there and do jobs, and like fans would, they wouldn't treat him like a loser after it. Oh, there's Coco. Let's dance while he's going
Yeah,
away.
Yeah, dude, yeah, yeah. It was. It was interesting. So it served, and, you know, it was kind of funny because in that match, there was a little bit of an angle, actually, afterwards with Tito Santana, who... He and Butch Reed kind of had a very forgettable program around this period.
Okay.
Poor Tito again, being a throw-in in a different match.
The periphery of WrestleMania, imagine that.
Yes. Well, what's kind of funny is he wins the first match in WrestleMania history, subsequently lost every WrestleMania appearance after that, Tito.
That's right.
Yeah, so.
That's right.
This was another, kind of going out of order. This was a blink. Again, though, the goal was to put somebody over. They put Butch Reed over. It really didn't go anywhere. Reed did have that program with superstar Billy Graham in the fall of it, which was one of many failed programs in 1987. You talk about, remember why 1987 kind of, we talked about the transition and what happened after the show.
Right.
That the Billy Graham comeback fell flat. The Ken Patera thing was their big post-WrestleMania angle, and that really fell flat.
Right. Yeah, that whole thing of... How fans were supposed to react in that angle. That fell flat. Here's another match without much of a storyline, but it ties into what we were saying about 87 and what was to come. Iron Sheik, Nikolai Volkoff with Slick versus the Killer Bees. The Sheik and Volkoff winning by disqualification. That match noted as the WWF on-camera debut, I believe, of Hacksaw Jim Duggan. Didn't he get involved at the end there and come out and do, USA, USA?
It wasn't. He had shown up. Mm-hmm. Prior, because it wasn't
okay.
like...
Okay, and maybe there was vignettes.
He was very, very, very new.
Brand new.
Yeah, but I remember
him on the big stage against the foreigners.
But he comes out, and it's not like... They weren't like, who is this man? They knew who he was. And,
right.
And he had... They kind of referenced that he had told Volkoff not to sing the anthem.
That's right.
Okay, so it wasn't his... I don't know if it was the first time we saw him... In a ring, I can't really remember, but he was very early on.
Yeah.
And this match was basically, you're right, there was nothing going on between the Bees and Sheik and Volkoff.
Right.
The Bees were already kind of in their perpetual,
jobber
to the Stars babyface tag team role. But this entire match was a backdrop for Duggan, who subsequently gets fired very shortly after the show for the famed, cocaine arrest with the Iron Sheik.
Right.
And by the way, it's kind of funny the way wrestling works. They weren't mad at him for doing cocaine. They were mad at him because they were feuding and caught together.
Right.
So
it made for a very entertaining hot seat interview with Iron Sheik in Pro Wrestling Illustrated back in '87. That was very interesting.
I want to know if they did the blow off the 2x4.
Oh!
I'm telling you right now, I'd pay any kind of money to be in the backseat of that car if I could have observed Jim Duggan just fucking blowing a big hog off the 2x4 and then giving the old thumbs up. Oh!
You know what you want to do? You want to be like the guys in Hot Tub Time Machine that could go back in time and capture that on a camera phone. I'd love to have that to put on YouTube today, Kyle Ross.
Yeah.
That would be awesome.
And then Sheik going, cocaine, number one, USA, Patui, yes. Okay. You know, but this was a bad, yeah.
That would be amazing.
It's kind of funny, too, the way it worked. You know, they win by DQ as Duggan just, like, hits the Sheik with a 2x4.
Right.
It's kind of funny, like, the baby face, like, how strong the lines were. Like, the Bees didn't care, you know.
Right.
In this era, that's something to point out, too. I think, like, they were like, oh, yeah, you know, we love the USA, too. We understand why you would completely ruin our match.
But... And we end up with the loser's end of the purse.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there we go. But, yeah, that you know, there weren't a lot of matches that didn't have – this was – it needs to point out, too, this was a popcorn match.
Yeah.
It was the match before Hogan Andre.
Right.
So,
well, you corrected me at least on one or two of these off air. I think I see one more that didn't have a program. I didn't realize that they were still going strong a year later, or at least in their death throes together. The Dream Team of Valentine and Beefcake with Johnny Valiant and Dino Bravo against the Rougeau brothers. They won that match over Jacques and Raymond.
Yeah, this is kind of funny. This was very poorly executed. I had a buddy. A couple of years ago, I love that. This is one of the few things that only I can recall. I loan him a tape of this, and he goes to me. He's like, "Yeah, I didn't really understand what happened to that Dream Team." He's like, "Could you? What was going on there?" It was very poorly executed. This again, much like the Bees versus Sheik and Volkov, as a backdrop for Duggan. The match was very ancillary.
It was a backdrop to abruptly turn Brutus face.
Yes, and do the new Dream Team, which was much worse than the original.
Mm-hmm.
With Dino Bravo would come in, and the decision was to turn. They're going to turn Beefcake face, and they needed to do something because the Dream Team had, you know, they had lost the belts to WrestleMania the year before. They really had done nothing. They went around still with the Bulldogs, and the house shows were unsuccessful.
A year was a long time to tread water, even with no pay per views and things moving slower. Yeah,
they weren't doing anything. The Rougeaus, by the way, terribly miscast his face. I mean, and the thing with this period, too, is they were still a long way away from that heel turn.
Right.
Which, you know, they were bad. They were just very happy-go-lucky. They're good workers.
Right.
Okay, very good
no
workers.
No direction for the characters.
But they had no direction here, and it did them no favors that they jobbed. You know, Bravo factors in the finish. They cheat to win. The commentators weren't even paying attention to this match. But Heenan comes up in the booth and starts cutting this promo for the later Hogan-Andre match. But... there's an angle that, and it becomes important for the Piper Dadas match, where there's a six-man tag, and it was one of those kooky things that would only happen in the 80s. Adonis accidentally cut off part of Beefcake's hair. It wasn't even explained during this match. It was. Have you ever seen it? That angle?
Yeah,
like,
I
it
have
was
a
really,
vague memory.
Like, Adonis wasn't, like, paying attention. It was something just so stupid.
Right.
And he accidentally cut off his hair, so they'd obviously already decided to turn Beefcake face, but... it's weird because the Dream Team wins, and, like, they just leave. Like, Beefcake, I forgot. There was a spot match where he, like, you know, Valentine was holding him, the Rougeau, and Beefcake missed and hit Valentine, and they just leave Beefcake. If you watch it and really don't know, like, what was going on at the time, and trust me, I'm one of the, like, five people, you know, that could probably recall this Adonis haircutting thing and stuff like that. You're like, what's going on here? It would make no sense. I mean, it was poorly executed, but you kind of give him a pass because, you know, Beefcake factors into the next match and again, gets a really sick... and it's funny, and I'll bring that point up when we talk about Piper Dadas, you know, gets a really good gimmick out of the whole thing. You know,
right.
Beefcake, I mean, it was really poorly executed, but Beefcake came out much better.
Right. No real storyline going into this pairing of the tag teams, but yeah, an angle would come out of it. The other match that didn't appear to have much of a storyline going in, but an angle, a WrestleMania moment would come out of it. The mixed tag match, Hillbilly Jim, Haiti Kid, and Little Beaver defeated King Kong Bundy, Little Tokyo, and Lord Littlebrook by disqualification. This is, of course, the WrestleMania moment of Bundy squashing the midgets.
Yeah, I think that there was a bit of a feud in late 86. I remember, like... Bundy beat down of Hillbilly Jim with some splashes vaguely, but still, it's kind of funny you talk about Bundy, you know, his trajectory in the first three WrestleManias. He goes from main eventer to kind of like, this was like the comedy throwaway. I remember Bob Uecker, them asking him about Little Beaver. He was on commentary. He's like, I think there's a whole lot of beaver all over this place. But you're right, yeah, this is the whole thing, you know. I hate midget wrestling, obviously. I mean, midget wrestling's terrible, but at least they didn't waste anyone
right.
good in this. And it's short, it's inoffensive.
See, I could have booked a program leading into this thing here. This is where I should have had the book.
The way
that I would have done this, I would have had King Kong Bundy start taunting Hillbilly Jim. I would have Bundy like start wearing an ascot and quoting Shakespeare and go with like a snob elitist thing against the hillbilly. I would have gone with it that way. Like I'm better than you.
Like Mitt Romney, perhaps.
Okay. Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
I would have him steal Mitt Romney's gimmick. Oh, yes. I wish I had a bell to ring. Huddle.
Okay.
But no, that's that whole thing, you know. Whole thing existed to set up that one moment. Nothing more,
nothing
less.
Which is interesting because nothing can... Bundy, you know, after this, it was over pretty much. He did main event a couple Saturday Night's main events against Hogan, but that was a backdrop to kind of resuscitate Hogan-Andre for the rematch. Hillbilly Jim, I mean...
This was a burial of Hillbilly Jim. How emasculated are you to lay there like, don't body slam my little friend?
I don't know. He was kind of like tied up, I think, or something
like
that.
I don't think there was much holding him back, if I remember correctly.
It was...
He got
no
buried.
No one jobbed here. No. He didn't get buried. It was funny because he stayed with the company for a while. He obviously he's behind the scenes. He's with the company for a while. He's a good ambassador for the company. But, he never worked. He was a terrible worker.
Happens when Hulk Hogan trains you.
Yes. But this was this was just vintage 1980s kind of light-hearted match, I guess.
Right. It didn't mean anything.
It would have sucked had Bundy not dropped the elbow on Little Beaver.
Oh, yeah, exactly. That made the moment. That justified their spot on the card. Yeah. Billy Jack Haynes and Hercules with Bobby Heenan fought to a double countout at 7:44. Now, you corrected me on this. I guess there was at least a sliver of a program heading into this
they
one.
They shot an angle. I like the, it's funny because this was like your two standard, like, roided up guys going against you. Both, you took juice to the gills. Jesus. I mean, I think George Zahorian was the referee for this match, okay? but I really like the psychology of this match. That might surprise you that I would say something like that, but very simple booking. Battle of the full, you have two guys using the same finishing hold, so it's a natural rivalry. That's how it started. It was Hercules called Billy Jack out to try to break his full Nelson, and Billy Jack, of course, obliged, like, put it on me, and then Heenan started taunting him, and then Hercules just clotheslined him from behind, which was, of course, glorious. But Billy Jack, he didn't, they did him no favors here. It's a double count out, but the heat kind of goes to Hercules afterwards. He beats him down.
Right.
It's interesting, too. These guys have a pretty good there. If you liked kind of the psychology of this, where both guys were going for the full Nelson and stuff like that, these guys have a good match after this. It was on a Coliseum tape. It's a chain match.
Okay.
It was pretty bloody, and Hercules wins. They used Billy Jack to put Hercules over eventually. This match is okay. I mean, it's not good or great, but I actually kind of like this.
Neither one of these guys, when it comes to the full Nelson, neither one of these guys was any Chris Masters.
Yeah,
certainly.
That Master Lock Challenge is kind of silly as it was. It was okay. I mean,
it got
in retrospect,
over.
It was kind of over.
It did. And Hercules, notable in this match in 1987, wrestling this match on the WrestleMania card 5 years before he would go on to become PWI Rookie of the Year.
Are we going to keep talking about that?
I think we are. Now we start to get to the...
A period, by the way, that saw Billy Jack Haynes also go to WCW as a mask as Black Blood.
That's right. By the way...
And suck also.
Have you ever seen that, and I excerpted it for part of it for a lounge promo once, the Billy Jack Haynes turn promo in Portland circa 1990?
No.
He's berating the fans for, like, not going to his gym that became bankrupt. You're all out of shape. You're all a bunch of fat so-and-sos.
No,
oh, it's great.
That is kind of awesome,
and,
actually.
And the announcer, and keep in mind, Billy Jack Haynes, lifetime Uber babyface in Portland, the announcer is selling it like Kennedy just got shot. I mean, it is the greatest sell job of any wrestling tragedy. I'll send it to you.
Yeah, I mean,
go look it up on YouTube. Billy Jack Haynes, 1990 turn.
Okay, it's kind of funny because this was sort of like Billy Jack's... He was brought in...
His only moment in the spotlight, really.
Yeah, I mean, they brought him and they pushed
him. Big regional star.
And they tried with him. Don't you think with Billy Jack Haynes... Hercules obviously stayed around for a long time. He was always in kind of mid-card purgatory, but he stayed around.
Right.
Billy Jack Haynes, aren't you, like, given the time period, I don't know if he maybe came in a year or two too late, doesn't it surprise you, given, what they looked for then, that he didn't get more over. I mean, he wasn't. I mean, you talked about it kind of tongue in cheek, this funny promo he cuts in Portland '90.
What was his gimmick though? I mean, muscular hick, I guess. But I mean, that's sort of, isn't that what Hillbilly Jim was? I mean, he was a better working Hillbilly Jim, which doesn't say much because he wasn't a great worker.
Yeah, but they were kind of Hillbilly Jim was kind of comedy always. Like Billy Jack Haynes was to be taken more seriously. I don't know. He had a good finish. I mean, the Full Nelson was. I mean, they got
right.
it over.
But here. I mean, you know, these were the cartoon days. What was the – if I were to say to you
– I don't know. To
Billy
me,
Jack Haynes, describe him to me. Like, what would you – okay.
You're yeah. right. Yeah, I mean, he had a funny hat. He had Oregon on his tights. I mean, but,
yeah.
You know, I mean
– he just didn't have a hook.
Yeah, I guess he
they
just
didn't, or they
yeah.
didn't develop one for him.
Yeah, I guess he – I mean
– right.
It just surprises me a little bit because, you know, he had the look. You got to think they probably were disappointed by him.
Well, here's the thing,
because by the
too.
End of the year, he was teaming with Ken Patera, Jabba to Demolition.
Here's the thing. And again,
even make the,
a
I mean,
guy who wrestled in Oregon, but also and most successfully in Oregon, decent runs in world class in Florida, fairly forgettable in Crockett just because he wasn't one of Dusty Rhodes' boys. But here's the thing. That's the downside to not acknowledging the history of anybody. This whole thing of we can rebuild anybody from scratch. With Billy Jack Haynes, you didn't have the margin of error to ignore his previous body of work. Not that his previous body
yeah,
of work
yeah,
justified
I don't,
it in a way that Harley Race's didn't. I'm not saying that. But Harley Race could come in and get over from scratch. Billy Jack Haynes couldn't.
Yeah, I guess maybe he just was too limited.
I think he was exposed.
Yeah, I guess he was just too limited.
He was exposed, and they didn't do much with his character. The ones that start to have a semblance of storyline to them, Harley Race with Bobby Heenan and the Fabulous Moolah defeated the Junkyard Dog at 422 in a Loser Must Bow match, and then JYD attacked him afterwards.
Yeah, of
to
course,
get his heat
getting
back.
The heat, but yeah.
Yeah.
This was kind of, by the way, at this point it was the Junk Food Dog.
Yes.
He was fat. I mean, he was real fat, and he didn't care anymore. This was sort of...
Grabbing a whole buttload of cakes.
Yeah, this was sort of the last of a series of attempts to put JYD in a program with kind of a veteran bump machine.
Right.
Because that's, I mean, if you watch this match, I mean, it's basically Race. I mean, even though he's older, he looked pretty, he bumped like a mofo in this match. I mean,
right.
He was bumping all over. Moolah, I don't really know what her purpose was, just maybe just to get
supposed
on the
to be royalty, I
yeah,
guess.
Yeah, the queen, she was the queen of wrestling
right.
or something. But, you know, it's kind of, I mean, Race goes over pretty shockingly clean with a belly-to-belly after he just bumps. I mean, it's in many ways, it's like that Adonis Elmer match from WrestleMania 2.
Yeah.
From where the heel just bumps for 4 minutes, it's a move out of nowhere and wins. That's what, and then you know, but it had that stip. You know, this did have an angle.
Right.
They tried to make him bow on a Saturday night's main event before this, and he
right.
of course wouldn't do it. You know, this country never had no king. You know, this country
right.
never had no queen. You know, so he kind of like curtsies to him, and he hits him with a chair and stuff,
but
like to get his heat back.
Here's the commonality with earlier in the card too: Orton and Morocco. We talk about '87 was a transitional year. This definitely marked doing a clean job here, Junkyard Dog,
on his
way down the card.
Yeah, JYD was pretty much done by this point.
Yes.
Now he. And this is kind of surprising. I guess it just shows how over he was at one, because he was the number. I mean, there was a period where he was the number two babyface in the company.
Well, after Snuka and Slaughter left,
yes.
yeah, probably
yes.
for
yes.
a period
around
of time.
Yeah, I would say around
and before Piper turned. So yeah,
yeah,
in that 85-86.
Yeah, I would say. I mean, he main evented house shows against Terry Funk, which was another of these long line of okay
B maybe even C shows if they were doing three cards
yeah.
a night. But yeah, no,
but
that's
main event.
Good.
It was a main event of a you know of
yeah.
a house. I've seen it. So,
well, he was a guy who was able. He was never acknowledged with his Watts history. But he was a guy that carried the aura of what he had done before and what he had been.
Well, he was
one of the
one
of the greatest regional draws of all time from like 80 to 84. He was a guy who carried that momentum in with him and rode it strongly into 86. But this was 87 we're talking about.
Yeah, and it's amazing. I was just thinking, he actually hung around for like a year and a half after this.
Yeah.
He
was
nothing.
Part of the great flush of late 88 with Morocco and the Bulldogs.
Yeah,
and
yeah. When there was a big turnover. We'll get to that, I'm sure, in the next one. But, yeah, I mean, I remember he did like this half-ass feud with Ron Bass after this.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Ron Bass whipped him. I remember Gene Oakland saying, please, Ron Bass, don't take us back to a terrible time in this country's history. I mean, God bless the WWE. He whipped him. Yeah, he like was Miss Betsy. Was, yeah, I mean.
Oh, yeah. The less said about Ron Bass, the better. I'm sure he's a nice guy, but the less said about him, the better.
And they said Skip Bayless was guilty of Negro baiting.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, I had nothing on Ron Bass.
Okay.
Oh, man.
But, yeah, I mean, again, it's – at least it, you cared, though, going into this.
Yeah.
For me, I remember as a kid, it seems silly now, especially if people know kind of my viewpoints. Or something. Oh, you cared about this? But I remember, like, there was anticipation. You know, the stipulation was kind of over. You know,
right.
Bowing to the way. You know, it kind of added a layer of intrigue to this.
Right. And it's one of those things you can look back on retroactively. Race and JYD with tremendous histories coming
in.
Yeah,
but two big names.
Big
too.
Names.
Yeah,
big draws. Harley... On a quasi-national level, going from promotion to promotion, doing very well as a traveling champion, JYD in a concentrated territory. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for a couple of years, being as big in a territory as anybody ever was,